This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The voting is done in virtually all the polling stations in and around Bulawayo. But we understand elsewhere across the country, especially in Harare, polling is still going on.
That was reporter Kudzenai Musenge on voting problems in Zimbabwe's election. Details coming up. Also, a look at the issue of presidential term limits ahead of Gabon's elections. And the U.S. presidential election campaign gets into gear. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. First, our top story, using constitutional amendments to extend presidential terms or help re-elect an incumbent president is seen frequently in Africa. The latest constitutional reform adopted by Gabon's parliament in April, ahead of national elections on Saturday, concerns, among other things, the term of office of the head of state by calling for a single round ballot. As a result, major opposition parties have called for a boycott of the parliamentary elections. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi possible remedies for abusing constitutions in Gabon and Africa at large.
I think the biggest challenge here is not even so much the constitutions or the letter of the constitution. I think the broader question here is the spirit of the constitution, because even dictatorships can have constitutions. Authoritarian governments can have constitutions, and authoritarians, dictators can get legally elected, but they violate those very same constitutions. You have these very illiberal democratic regimes. In other words, you have a facade of democratic institutions, but the executive emasculates the whole process. So I think a bigger challenge for a country like Gabon is to think about how do you entrench the rule of law, number one, but how do you entrench institutions? And entrenching those institutions around constitutions that are actually respected in the context of the spirit of the constitution, in addition to the letter of the law. And by that, I mean, how do you create conditions in a country where the norms of democratic governance, in other words, the behavior, the political behavior, and the regimes that are established are broadly accepted across the political space as legitimate. It's not just so much about having a document called a constitution, but how are the behaviors associated with that, with the spirit of that constitution? How are those articulated? So really reinforcing the rule of law, good governance, constitutional rule in the letter of the law, but more importantly, in the respect of the spirit of that law.
But do you see any role for the African Union or ECOWAS in fighting the term limit extensions in Gabon and other countries?
I think African Union has had many challenges. I wouldn't write off the role of the African Union, but let's not forget a lot of the member states, a lot of the presidents, a lot of the countries that are members of the AU do not respect these democratic norms. We've seen the wave of military takeovers in the Sahel. We know about a lot of the regimes that pseudo-democratic, in other words, it's democracy in name only. These are not leaders. These are rulers who use the facade of democracy, of constitutions, to elongate their power. So to your question, the AU has several mechanisms. For example, the Africa Peer Review Mechanism, for example, the African Election Observers Mechanism, the Elders, African Elders Grouping. We also have the heads of state meetings, which are regularly held. But as I said, a lot of those ones are dominated by heads of countries where constitutions are actually being abused to perpetuate the rule of one individual. But lastly, I must also add, there's also external factors that we need to consider when we're thinking about the case of countries like Gabon and these authoritarian regimes. and more specifically, for example, the hand of France in perpetuating the rule of the Bongos. France has a very significant oil interest in the Gabon. Recently, Macron visited Gabon in March of this year, and that was seen by the opposition as some form of Macron electioneering in favor of Ali Bongo to give him some kind of international legitimacy. So France is a major player in these countries, particularly around security, particularly in regards to economic aid, but also particularly in stashing a lot of the ill-gotten wealth of some of these regimes.
That was David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York. He was speaking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy by phone. Zimbabwe extended the vote for one more day in selected wards after voting materials were not distributed on time yesterday at many polling stations. A presidential notice said 40 wards were affected by the delays. Hundreds of voters waited for hours in line to cast their ballots. President Emmerson Mnangagwa is seeking re-election after a first term that saw soaring inflation and currency shortages. He faces 10 other candidates, including his main challenger, Nelson Chamisa, of the Citizens Coalition for Change. Reporter Kuzani Masenge tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that voting was not extended today in Zimbabwe's second largest city, Bulawayo.
Despite the late start to the polling in most places in Bulawayo, there aren't any polling stations that are open now. Voting is done in virtually all the polling stations in and around Bulawayo. But we understand elsewhere across the country, especially in Harare, polling is still going on.
So the polling stayed open hours later yesterday. Were people standing in long lines in Bulawayo that you could see when it came evening time? Do you still see these heavy long lines that you had described yesterday earlier?
Yes, in two wards, notably in one of the constituencies where the finance minister, who is a ruling party member, Mthuli Ncube, is contesting against Raphael Swanda of the Citizens Coalition for Change movement. So polling started very late. I think it was in that place where it started the latest. It started around lunchtime. So in the evening, people were still queuing to vote, but when polling started, it was fast, and by early morning, it was done. In places that I went to that had started earlier, the results were posted by 6 a.m.
Were any irregularities reported in the ballot polling places that you visited?
Not in the places that I visited. I was able to talk to the polling agents of the opposition, and they told me that everything went smoothly. The only problem that they had was that polling started late in all the places. So no irregularities except for the delay. But we understand elsewhere in Harare, members of two organizations that are civic society organizations that advocate for free and fair elections, the Zimbabwe Election Support Network and the Election Resource Center, they are members of staff. I think 39 of them were arrested overnight for apparently breaching sections of the law that prohibits ordinary people from announcing or publicizing results before the official announcement from ZEC. So I spoke to the lawyers representing them, and they are still to appear in court.
Aside from the late balloting and because of the problems that the Electoral Commission said were problems with the delays in printing, what were they telling you? Were they hopeful? Were they optimistic, the voters that you talked to?
Yes, people remain hopeful. If you are saying, obviously, the delays are meant to rig the election, but in spite of that, people remain hopeful for change from the results that have been trickling in so far, but obviously not a majority of them. The opposition leader, the main opposition leader, Nelson Chamisa, has been leading in the presidential race against President Emmerson Mnangagwa. So people remain hopeful, but as always, the results that come in later are from the rural areas. There's always the challenge of network and so forth.
That's reporter Kudzanai Musenge speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. The reported death of Wagner Group chief Yevgeny Prigozhin in an airplane crash has once again put the spotlight on Russian President Vladimir Putin. Prigozhin, presumed dead, could have significant ramifications for the future of the Wagner Group of mercenaries and Russian foreign policy in regions such as Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America. For a better understanding on the matter, I first asked Voice of America Russian service reporter Danila Galaprovich, who is closely monitoring the story, to talk to us about the crash and the passengers.
What we can say now is that Russian official departments, Russian officials were very quick to inform the public about Prigozhin and his close allies being on the board of this plane, which crashed over Russia. And Federal Air Transport Agency, for example, almost immediately published a list of passengers, as you said, and it was including Prigozhin. Many media started to try to confirm his death with people associated with him, and death of Prigozhin was actually confirmed in social medias, but which are connected to Wagner Group, like Gray Zone Telegram channel. And according to several journalists in Russia, employees of Prigozhin's structures began to be notified about the death of the boss.
Many blame Putin and other Russian officials for orchestrating his death and are threatening retaliatory action against Moscow. Social media channels linked to the Wagner alleged that Russia air defenses shot down the plane.
We cannot say if there is any truth in that or not, but we can definitely confirm that allies of Prigozhin are very angry. And I noticed in one of Telegram channels that the group associated with Prigozhin and part of the Wagner Group mercenaries, so they said that this death of Prigozhin was arranged by the traitors of Russia. They threatened about the new mutiny and new march to Moscow. So many experts say that despite that Putin may show to the Russian elite that he was not afraid of this attempt of coup d'etat or mutiny 2 months ago. In the public opinion, and especially in ultra-patriots, Putin played rather badly, and probably he undermined his image amongst those who supports his campaign in Ukraine.
So what comes next? How might Wagner change? Will the Kremlin likely seize control of Russia's Wagner mercenary company?
A lot of experts are saying now that operation of the Wagner Group in Africa, for example, as well as in Syria and in other places, will not stop after the death of Prigozhin and his subordinates who was on a plane. I just remind our listeners that there were more 6 people from Wagner Group at that board, including Dmitry Utkin, who gave the name Wagner because he had a nickname, Wagner, and that's how Wagner Group was named after Mr. Utkin. So
the second in command, right?
Yes, he was a second in command, but there were many others, including one of them who was operating in Sudan, for example. So experts with whom I spoke almost immediately after the news, Kimberly Martin from Barnard College, she said that in Africa, the Wagner units in each of the countries where they operate are under command of separate commanders. So perhaps the Kremlin will just force this local commanders of Wagner divisions to move along with their subordinates under the leadership of other private military companies, for example, Company Redoute, which was organized also in Africa and in Syria, because Kremlin would like to continue to receive incomes from operations initiated by Yevgeny Prigozhin in Africa, but without the problems that he himself created for Kremlin.
That was Voice of America Russian Service reporter Danila Galaprovich. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Today, we have special guests here at VOA in Washington, several fellows with the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, a U.S. State Department program that helps young leaders build tools, foster economic growth and democratic structures on the continent. The visitors have been touring our building and meeting journalists here. At a reception at our headquarters, my colleague Carol Van Dam caught up with a few of them to talk about the skills they learned on the program and applying those skills when they head home. This is Memory Mbewa from Malawi.
So I wanted to join YALI because of the opportunities that it offers me as a young professional, but also as a young activist. Just the network and the availability of being able to connect with other young people across Africa that are also doing tremendous things in their communities and making sure that they are playing their role in changing their communities. So I wanted to be part of that community to learn how my fellow young people do the work that they do, and just to see what I can take back home. But also, just to learn more about the American community and the exchange, and also to connect and to share the culture and to see also how they are dealing with their daily issues that they do.
So tell me a little bit about why you were chosen and your country and what you hope to do in your country when you go back.
Back home, I'm a child rights activist, so I use television, radio, and online platforms to advocate for the rights of children and youth in Malawi. So I was chosen because I was one of the young people that are using the available resources that I have to ensure that I'm making a difference in my community. So I work as an advocacy manager in a local radio and television station. So that is why I was chosen.
So if you drill down on that, what you say you're doing at home already, what do you hope to achieve when you go back home and, you know, kind of ramp up what you're already doing?
So when I go back home, I plan to maybe vamp a little more of the communities that I work with in terms of maybe training young people also in terms of their advocacy, so that there's one voice in terms of advocacy. But I'm also looking into skills development, because a lot of young people, there's little opportunities that are there. So I'm looking into bringing to them skills that would enable them to be self-reliant as young people, so that when they are doing issues of advocacy, they can be able to find their own initiatives, they can be able to take themselves to school, just to make sure that some of the things that really help, that really hinders them maybe to not to go to school are very limited. So I'm looking at working with young women so that they're able to maybe provide for their children so that they break the cycle of poverty.
That was Memory Mbewa, a YALI fellow from Malawi. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. For more on YALI, check out voaafrica.com, and we'll hear from more YALI fellows tomorrow. Wednesday night in the U.S., eight of the Republican Party presidential candidates clashed on the debate stage. It was the first political debate ahead of the 2024 presidential election, and notably, the leading candidate, former President Donald Trump, was not there. VOA senior national correspondent Steve Herman was at the debate in the Midwestern city of Milwaukee, and we spoke a few hours ago about what he saw. He started with some of the highlights.
Well, as you know, we have Donald Trump again trying to get his old job back in 2024 and hoping for a rematch with the presumptive Democratic Party nominee, the incumbent Joe Biden. Trump was not on the stage last night, but we had eight other candidates who want to also be president. So this was really the big kickoff for the 2024 election cycle with this two-hour televised debate on Fox News, with the moderator saying early on that they wanted to talk about the elephant who is not in the room, which was Donald Trump. And the candidates did talk a lot about Donald Trump.
So the candidates had sparred over a variety of issues ranging from abortion and the economy to Ukraine and education. Did anybody make good points?
Yeah, there were some very spirited discussions on these issues. And we saw, especially on some aspects of foreign policy, that clear differences emerged between some of the candidates when we're talking about Ukraine. For example, we had the former governor of South Carolina, who had also been an ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, who was very supportive of Ukraine, while another ethnic Indian politician, a novice, Vivek Ramaswamy from the state of Ohio, who's been rising in the polls, he was much more skeptical of U.S. support to Ukraine, saying that China is actually the bigger threat to the United States than Russia.
And the eight Republicans were asked whether they would support Trump as the party's nominee, even if he was convicted of a crime. All but two said they would. Could you talk?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the two who were in the minority camp were the former governor of the state of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, who is in single digits in the polls, and then also a former friend of Donald Trump, the former New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, who seems to be in this race solely as a flamethrower to say that Trump should not be president again. He violated the Constitution, and he's not qualified to be president ever again.
And finally, let's talk about the elephant not in the room, Mr. Trump, turning himself in at the Fulton County Jail in the state of Georgia, where he has been charged with criminal activity because of his efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss. How is that expected to play out?
Yeah, we're just hours away from that occurring at the Fulton County Jail, where Trump will surrender. He is now facing four serious criminal cases in all, 91 felony counts against him for criminal acts allegedly committed before, during, and after his presidency.
VOA Senior National Correspondent Steve Herman, thank you for your input.
My pleasure.
The West African bloc, ECOWAS, has rejected the Niger coup leader's proposed 3-year transition to democratic rule. The ECOWAS Commissioner for Peace and Security, Abdel Fattah Moussa, told the Associated Press that the door for diplomacy with Niger's junta remained open, but the bloc will not engage in drawn-out talks that lead nowhere. Moussa said ECOWAS heads of state and the commission think if the Niger coup stands, it could have a domino effect in the region, and so they are determined to stop it. His comments come as Algeria sends a high-ranking official to Niger today as part of its diplomatic push in the aftermath of the coup. The French news agency AFP says the Algerian Foreign Ministry Secretary General, Louen Magaraman, posted on X, formerly Twitter, that he will visit Niger. The announcement comes a day after Algerian Foreign Minister Ahmed Attaf began a tour of West African countries in a bid to find a solution in Niger. Algiers says it opposes any ECOWAS plans for military intervention in Niger. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Shogun Chung, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music, balance it. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM stations.